Hello and welcome. I'm Ben Schultz.
I'm Nora Schultz.
And you're listening to Trying to Adapt, and today we're trying to adapt to A Christmas Carol, a new opera.
Can I say really quick, why do you always say trying to adapt to?
I thought that would be a funny kind of bit, like, to start every episode. Like,
but I don't get it.
Like, the idea is, like, we're trying to adapt to the thing we just watched.
Okay.
It's based on the wordplay of the title. I'm leaving this in.
Okay, yeah. Because now the listener gets it. They probably did already.
Well, right off the bat, just looking at the title, A New Opera, that gives us the question of, is there another opera based on A Christmas Carol that we should know about? Should we have watched that first? Is it important?
I mean, probably at some point. Hopefully also recorded. Hopefully recorded with better equipment.
Yeah, this is like a stage opera, and someone just recorded it on a normal camera, so can't really see or hear exactly what's going on for most of it.
Now, thankfully, we have an encyclopedic knowledge of what happens in A Christmas Carol. And also, fortunately, there were a couple moments where, like, say, a line was sung that was difficult to make out, and I could hear laughter in the audience, which makes me think that the opera itself is probably coherent. It was just recorded on very bad quality. Now, I'm used to watching theater bootlegs. The visuals didn't necessarily bother me. I'm used to kind of a blurry view of the actors. The audio recording quality was a little uncomfortable, just due to the fact that you really can't make out what's being said. And unlike with theater bootlegs, where, okay, I'll watch the bootleg for the staging and I'll listen to the music on the cast recording, I couldn't find any information about this opera when I searched for it. It might be out there, and if you find some, you should let us know. We couldn't find any lyrics or other recordings of this, so that would be helpful.
Yeah, this was on YouTube. As with the last episode, the video had less than 1,000 views, so this is a fairly obscure kind of thing. I think actually, like, the guy who wrote the opera was there in the YouTube comments, so hopefully he finds out about this episode.
That would be nice. Yeah, this is two in a row now where we've watched very recent, very obscure YouTube videos of versions of A Christmas Carol. What's cool about this also is that there's a live orchestra.
The orchestra isn't, like, in a pit. It's actually in the back of the stage, behind the action.
Which I personally think is kind of cool, sometimes, and this could also just be due to poor recording quality, the music kind of drowns out the vocals, especially for lower singers, such as Scrooge, which may be a bit of an issue, but like I said, this might not be a problem when you see it live.
What we're asking you to do is donate to our GoFundMe to buy tickets to the next production of this opera so that we can give it a better review.
Because this is an opera, it begins with original music, or at least new to me. It might be old music, but it's not A Christmas Carol, as so many of them begin with, which I'm just realizing is pretty clever.
Yeah, you're just realizing the wordplay in the title of the original book.
Well, not really the wordplay in the title, but the fact that, like, so many adaptations begin with a literal Christmas Carol being sung over the title being shown. Also cool in the music is that they play the Big Ben bell chime. You know what I'm talking about?
The Westminster chimes. I actually made a note of the fact that, you know, I couldn't really understand what most of the actors were saying, but we actually did get confirmation in the music itself that this is running on the 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m. schedule rather than spreading it out over several nights.
Oh yeah, because after they would play the chime, then they would also play just like a solid note. Representing the ringing of a bell, like, once, twice, or three times, which I also thought was really cool. Overall, I'm just gonna say right now that the music, from what I could make out, was really fantastic. Do you agree with me here?
Yeah, definitely.
It slapped. Not only did it slap, though, but I also felt like it was very good in capturing the mood and setting of A Christmas Carol. Not necessarily that, like, if you took me to it blindfolded, I'd definitely be like, yeah, this is A Christmas Carol. I mean, maybe I would because my brain is so saturated right now with A Christmas Carol, but it definitely has a Victorian London Christmassy feel to it, while also the music sounds original. The set design is pretty sparse, with just kind of like a door representing various doorways. Scrooge's bed is really the only furniture in his house. Scrooge's table, not even a desk that he writes at, is pretty much the only furniture in his office, and so on. Which is also, I'm kind of a sucker for that in set design, so I mean that as a positive. Now, while I couldn't make out most of the lyrics, in the opening number, what I could definitely make out is them dramatically singing Scrooge and Marley, and Marley and Scrooge.
An inseparable pair. A buddy cop comedy.
A torrid romance. Out of the song lyrics that I could understand, what I also noticed were a lot of quotes directly from the book. You will later understand my passionate love for transcribing written words, like, directly from a book to music when I get a chance to go off about Great Comet for like an hour. For now, let's just say I thought it was really cool. Also, the costumes, at first, my first impression was that they were pretty, like, you know, period accurate. As time went on, I realized they really weren't, but that was only after thinking about it for a long period of time. So at first glance, they seem very Victorian England, and that's probably the effect they were going for.
Just in, like, the first part of the story, I have, like, a few notes about interesting kind of changes that I noticed. In the part where Scrooge's nephew gives the big speech about how great Christmas is, and this causes Bob Cratchit to involuntarily start clapping, and that makes Scrooge mad at him.
Oh, not only does it make Bob start involuntarily clapping, but this starts the audience applause as well for, like, Fred's solo. Which I thought was really cool. I like that kind of, I don't really know how to describe that, like, as an effect.
Yeah, it was a cool effect, like, as a cue for the audience to start applauding. That is what I was gonna say.
Oh, maybe it wasn't even on purpose, who knows? But it definitely creates a cool effect when you're watching a recording of the, because the recording, from where it's being filmed, you can kind of see the backs of some of the audience members. You both hear and see this applause happening directly in response to a character's in-story applause.
Now, I like what you're suggesting about the possibility that it wasn't intended by the creators, and maybe, in fact, they were actually kind of pissed off that, like, that's not a moment where you're supposed to be clapping and they have to, like, take an unexpected pause.
Well, I did notice that you don't really hear any other applause throughout, because, it's an opera, it's either, if someone isn't singing, then there's full orchestration happening. I didn't hear any other applause until the end that I can think of, so that might have actually kind of pissed them off. But I, as an audience member of a sorts, thought it was cool. Another interesting change in this adaptation is this Scrooge is rather violent.
Yeah.
Very violent.
Yeah, there's a group of carolers singing God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. Classic, and Scrooge tries to beat one of the carolers with his cane and, like, stops mid-swing, and I think the caroler that he almost beats up is played by the same actor as Tiny Tim, and it's, like, the same costume and everything, so I have to wonder whether it's actually Tiny Tim that he was about to beat up.
Or if it wasn't Tiny Tim, then maybe, like, this character and Tiny Tim are both supposed to represent this kind of, like, every man, every boy who's poor. Around the point of the God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen carolers that Scrooge almost beats, I'm not entirely sure if this was going on here, because, like I said, the video quality is about as bad as the audio quality, but from what I could tell, off stage, while the people asking for charity, who are women in this version, While the people asking for charity come to Scrooge's office, you can see Marley on the side of the stage, kind of half, like he's half standing in the light. So it creates a kind of ghostly appearance. And as Scrooge bids them farewell, you can see Marley shake his head and leave. I thought that was perfect. And I also think it's something that can really only be achieved via the stage. So I liked to see... I will complain about staging later on, but that was one moment where I felt like the directors really took advantage of the medium.
Speaking of can only be achieved on the stage, every format comes with its own particular advantages and its own limitations for how you can adapt a story into that medium. And in this case, the whole Marley scene is very interesting in this version. And in this version, it actually starts off with Marley just standing outside Scrooge's door, which obviously it would be impossible to have just his face appear, because that's an actual person.
It wouldn't be impossible if they cut a hole in it. Kind of like one of those, like, carnival, like, take pictures where you put your head in the... But that's just me. That's just my director's vision. I think it'd be cool. I don't think anybody else would.
And then Marley just, like, lets himself in, and Scrooge just kind of follows him, and he's like, where did Marley go?
Another thing that I thought was kind of weird about the Marley moment is that, like, the lights come up on Marley, like, being super scary, standing outside of Scrooge's house, and then the dramatic musical sting plays, like, a second later. And maybe this is supposed to be, like, Scrooge recognizing Marley, but from the audience's perspective, it was kind of weird because you're immediately like, holy shit, it's Jacob Marley, and then the music plays as a kind of delayed reaction, which I found a little jarring, a little weird.
Another really interesting change in the Marley sequence, something that is in the book that we don't usually see included in adaptations, is the fact that after Marley visits, Scrooge very briefly gains the ability to see, I think, all of the ghosts in the world. He sees, like, these wailing ghosts who are, like, trying to help people, but unlike Marley, they've completely lost the ability to do so. In this version, I think we get what's intended as, like, an allusion to that. We have the entire ensemble cast appear as ghosts who are chanting Ebenezer alongside Marley. And then the scene break actually comes when the ghosts kind of like descend on him and they surround him and they cover him and then it goes black.
One thing that I think kind of sucked about that scene as well, I thought it was really cool that the ensemble's all ghosts now. They didn't change their appearance at all, and the only way that you can really tell that they're dead is they're all kind of, like, standing with a limp. Which, like, it would have been okay if Jacob Marley also looked like this, but no, like, Jacob Marley is in the full, like, chains and ghost attire. So he looks definitely out of place, and there's a second where it's like, wait, are these people also supposed to be ghosts? Because we know what a ghost looks like. We can look at Jacob Marley, and they don't look like him. But it is only for a second. So, I'll forgive them.
Maybe that's just a Jacob Marley thing and not a ghost thing. And then we move into the segment with the spirits of Christmas. And I always find it interesting which of the little vignettes of Scrooge's past and of the present and future that adapters decide to leave in and which to not put in. It's like they have a list and they're checking off, like, okay, so we want this and we want this. We're gonna leave this out.
Yeah, basically. It's like they're making a sandwich at Subway. And sometimes my favorite ingredients are left in, and then sometimes my favorite ingredients are left out. One thing I will say about the Ghost of Christmas Past sequence is that, once again, she is a woman. Great. She has a beautiful voice. But as for her costume, she's wearing this cool kind of ghostly, like, cape with hood. But then underneath, it looks like she just kind of has, like, a black shirt and leggings on. Which, like... I am 100% here for a kind of like modernized or timeless Christmas Carol, but considering that everybody else is in, at the very least, like vaguely 1800s clothing, I mean, I get that she's a ghost.
But she's the ghost of Christmas past. If anything, she should be dressed up as like a person from the 1700s or earlier.
Or, like, you know, a lot of adaptations go the route of just having her wear this kind of timeless, like, white dress that could really belong to any era. But here, instead, she's wearing leggings, which, especially paired with the cool, like, long cape and hood, you can tell that was clearly the point that they wanted you to pay attention to. Around this point, while trying to make out what the Ghost of Christmas Past was saying, I realized that opera as a medium, I feel like you're not really trying to tell a comprehensible story.
Right. I think definitely you were right when you suggested that with something like this, you have to know the story of A Christmas Carol before you go into it. If you had never heard of A Christmas Carol, you're going to have absolutely no hope of following the plot.
See, and I think, though, that maybe A Christmas Carol is the perfect kind of story to turn into an opera, because it pretty closely resembles a lot of the classic movies. We've already seen one of them with the Reginald Owen version. You know, most people have seen a version of A Christmas Carol before. This pretty closely resembles a lot of the more famous ones. If anything, I think the story makes for a fantastic opera because they can take liberties knowing, okay, people know the classic lines. People know the story. We don't have to focus on making this story very easily understood and can instead just try to capture the visual and audio and emotional aspects of creating. I'm not an opera expert, but I think that this version, as probably a lot of operas do, the strength of the medium is creating the emotional mood of a story rather than telling it straight. If you wanted to do that, you know, you would create
just a normal musical.
Or even a play. But instead, they picked an opera because I think then you can really. Operas are great for melodrama. It's what they're known for. And this story is chock full of melodrama, and you get some fantastic lines fully belted with the orchestra behind them, and it feels as if this is how these lines should always be said. I just wish that we could see and hear this music with better quality.
So just to go through the part with the Ghost of Christmas Past, she shows him himself as a boy when he was in boarding school, but like we don't really get to see him sitting there alone. We go pretty much directly to the part where his sister comes to collect him.
I feel like that kind of ruined the whole, like, Scrooge is a lonely kid and that's why he's like this. I mean, maybe the lyrics talk about how lonely he is, but from a staging point of view, we really only see him talking to his sister.
The lyrics in that part are, I think, mostly just Scrooge going, "I was a boy.
Good heaven, I was a boy."
That's fair.
And then we get to the Fezziwig party, in which we hear A Christmas Carol, which is not, I think, very often used. I saw three ships come sailing in.
Ooh, I liked that, because that is kind of, that's a rollicking Christmas song, you know?
Yeah.
That's like a pub song.
Perfect for that kind of setting, and then they end with
cheers!
Also, I think Fezziwig had a man bun.
I didn't notice that.
I know I complained about, like, modern costumes earlier, but I'm 100% here for Fezziwig's man bun. I think that if that were, like, a thing back in the 1800s, Fezziwig 100% seems like the kind of guy that would have one. You know, he's like the cool, like, he's your cool boss with the man bun.
Yeah, he's like your high school art teacher.
Maybe your high school art teacher. I don't have a high school art teacher. Also, during the Fezziwig party, I think there may have been a moment where Scrooge meets his fiance. Did you notice that?
I didn't notice that.
There is a part where I think Scrooge, I'm assuming Scrooge because there's kind of like, it's center stage, so it'd be kind of weird to be showing this moment with like some random businessmen, where Scrooge and this woman, like he kisses her hand and then walks away kind of thing. Like there's this sort of, it seems like they're meeting for the first time, or at the very least, like, don't know each other very well. And I think, just judging like the color of the dress, I think that's the woman who later plays Scrooge's fiance.
And getting into that, I think most adaptations, more often than not, when the Ghost of Christmas Past mentions the fact that his fiance broke up with him because he was a greedy bastard, he, like, freaks out and refuses to see it and then, like, makes the Ghost of Christmas Past go away. In this version, he does not get the chance to do that, and he has to watch his fiance break up with him.
Yes, we finally get a scene with Scrooge and his fiance. This is one of my favorite parts of the book, and it always gets cut out every single time because I don't know why. Maybe people don't feel like hiring an extra actress. Maybe they're just thinking about time constraints, and they're thinking about which scenes have the most recognizable characters and lines. But the way that the fiance digs into Scrooge for being a capitalist are fantastic. The entire scene is great, and it also builds so, like, an important part of Scrooge's character. Now, I couldn't make out the lyrics in this part, but from what I can tell, Scrooge's fiance totally digs into Scrooge. I thought that this scene was perfect. I was so happy. And then, I think the actor who plays Marley, but, like, old Marley, comes up to young Scrooge, puts a hand on his shoulder, and then has him, like, walk back to the desk, which I think is supposed to signify, you know, he's turning to business. But number one, it's old Marley. They couldn't be bothered to hire a young Marley actor.
Or just have another young man from the pretty large ensemble cast play the role temporarily.
Oh yeah, because this man does not even sing. He comes, you can barely even, like, Ben didn't even notice this moment. I think it was supposed to be Marley. It could have been anybody. It could have really just been, like, any man in, like, a rich business suit. But no, instead, it was an old man, I think Marley. Another reason why I don't really like this moment is that it kind of seems to imply that Scrooge is turning from his fiance, like, not of his own volition. You know, that he's, like, being peer pressured by Marley or something, which, you know, may be the case. But in the book, Charles Dickens really focuses on how, you know, this is Scrooge's fuck up. The fact that his father more or less abandoned him as a kid is not his fuck up, but the fact that as an adult, he couldn't keep this relationship with this woman that he loved because he was so focused on money, that's his fault. This weird little moment, I think, kind of absolves Scrooge of some of this guilt. I think he deserves all of it.
The Ghost of Christmas Present is carrying what I think is an actual real lit torch.
Yeah, if it wasn't a lit torch, then it was at least a fancy electronic torch. Also, the Ghost of Christmas Present's costume, in case any of you were wondering, is totally normal. It's what you're imagining.
Ghost of Christmas Present seems like kind of the most obvious character in maybe the entire story to just, like, this is what the Ghost of Christmas Present is.
I would say he's the hardest to get wrong, but then there was the Vincent Price version where he was just, like, a madman executive who put on, like, a weird robe.
Mad men.
Yeah.
You said madman.
I think I said madman.
No, you said madman. The listeners will decide.
Oh, you're keeping this in?
Part of it. Whenever I correct you, I always keep it in.
Okay. The listener's gonna think I'm stupid.
Yeah, but it counterbalances the fact that you're actually smarter than me.
What?
Okay, let's
You're keeping this in too?
Let's move on.
So in the Cratchit scene, as far as I could tell, Tiny Tim is the only one who's actually played by a child actor.
And in fact, I actually made a note about what I think were supposed to be Ignorance and Want, the two ghostly spirits who grab Scrooge by either arm at the end of the Ghost of Christmas Present sequence. The reason I say I think they're supposed to be Ignorance and Want is because they're very much not children.
Oh yeah, like they're adults. But at the same time, I was thinking maybe that's like a little bit less weird.
Yeah, but it also makes it difficult to understand exactly what they're doing.
That's fair. Yeah, overall, I always find the inclusion of the Ignorance and Want kids chilling, but kind of like don't think about it too hard.
It's the kind of thing that works a lot better in the original book, because, like, you can just say, the Ghost of Christmas Present had two children under his robe, and it's like, okay. But when you try to depict that, it gets extremely weird really, really fast.
Where did he get these children from? And then also, I think I said in the first episode that, like, I'm a little unsure about what the Ignorance and Want thing is actually supposed to mean. Like I said, don't think about it too hard. However, I do like that the Ignorance and Want kids, whatever they are. In the book, they don't say anything to him, as far as I can tell, but here they do directly, like, sing at him. Which was a cool effect. Also, around this point, we actually, like, watch, like, what it would be like if Tiny Tim died. I think that was supposed to be that. Where, like, there's a chair in the center, and I'm pretty sure it's the actor who plays Bob Cratchit and is accompanied by his wife. I think it was Tiny Tim because, like I said, I think he was the only child actor I noticed. Like, he's sitting in Bob Cratchit's arms, and then he, like, carries him away hurriedly. Which, at the very... it might not be his death. Maybe just, like, increasing illness.
So then we meet the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, who is also a woman, and the reason that we know this is because she actually gets the opportunity to not really sing, but she does vocalize.
See, I knew that she was a woman because later on for Babs, she takes her hood off, and you can see that not only is she a woman, she's a black woman. Representation matters. I don't mean that sarcastically, I'm being serious. I don't know why I said it like that. I didn't notice that those were her vocalizations. I thought that maybe, because I just kind of assumed that the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come was being played by a man, and that maybe those vocalizations were coming from some other female actress, but they probably were her.
I was wondering that too, but her mouth was always open when that happened, so I figured it must be her.
Oh yeah, you can kind of see her mouth. That would explain why the hood is so, like it doesn't come down very low, because that would muffle the sound.
In this version, we actually do see the poor people who take Scrooge's stuff after he dies, and they do get the opportunity to sing about how happy they are that he's dead.
While they do this, though, they do a weird kind of dance, which, like, well, I appreciated it. From an objective standpoint, I felt like it was a little out of place. It's a cool dance, though. I was trying to figure out, because I think they might have been the charity collectors from earlier, because they were wearing, I think, the same costumes.
Who were also women.
I think I pointed that out earlier. If I didn't, yes, they were women. Yeah, that leads right into the scene with the thieves. The music slaps extra hard around that part. You should honestly watch this version. Just, like, put it on in the background and have the music play. Because while I did think that the staging was cool in some parts, it's overall, like, it's pretty much what you're expecting. They don't do anything super out of the box. But this is music I would honestly just listen to. Like, that I would have on in the background.
If the audio quality were better.
If the audio quality were better. Also, speaking of staging, I noticed that there were some parts where Scrooge was watching people, and we know, knowing about the A Christmas Carol, I always call it The Christmas Carol.
It's because we started with that one that was called The Christmas Carol.
But as experts of A Christmas Carol, we obviously know that the people that Scrooge is watching can't see him. But there are some parts in the staging where he's, like, standing kind of, like, weirdly close to them and isn't, like, occupies the same light as them, to the point where it feels like they could just turn around and see him. I feel like that could have been made a little clearer on the staging that, okay, Scrooge is, he's watching, but he's watching from a different plane. I think that could have been done really coolly with, like, lights and set design, but they kind of missed that opportunity.
I thought that Scrooge's gravestone looked really interesting in this version because I think generally, you know, the implication is that he's a miser and he doesn't want to spend a lot of money even on his own funeral and his own gravestone. So usually we get like a very kind of plain gravestone or even one that's just kind of laid into the ground. In this version, we couldn't really see it well enough to like make out any particular details, but I think it had, like, an angel carved on top.
Yeah, I'm assuming it had Ebenezer Scrooge written in it. Couldn't make it out from here.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure the audience probably couldn't even read that.
Yeah, I saw a stage production of it last year where they had the letters, like, light up, and at the time I thought it was kind of dumb, but now that I'm thinking about it, like, you know, if you're not familiar with that iconic moment where Scrooge realizes it's his grave, that might be a better way of doing that. Yeah, so earlier I mentioned how, you know, Scrooge has a lower voice, which I think is perfect for his character, but that sometimes, you know, this doesn't get really picked up, especially with the orchestra behind. and his sort of like graveside monologue, which you should know by this point I always love and look forward to, you really like can't hear him singing at all. Until towards the end where he like belts out the classic like I will live in the past, present, and future line. But overall, he doesn't really get any like sick belting parts. And there are some fantastic like operatic belting parts throughout, but Scrooge doesn't get any of them. And I feel like that would have been a great moment to show his like desperation and fear. But at least from this recording, we don't really get that. What we do get though is that when Scrooge wakes up, he laughs. But not so maniacally in this version, which I have complained slightly in the past about Scrooge's kind of creepy laughter. They kind of sidestepped that here, which, you know, that's an extra point. There's no point system.
Scrooge actually goes out into the street and finds a child to buy the turkey and tell him that it's Christmas Day. Here's another example of the limitations of the stage. Is that obviously the staging does not really allow for Scrooge to yell down from a window at someone.
Overall, like the ending, they don't even really show Scrooge going to either the Cratchit's house or Fred's house, as is normally done. Instead, they just kind of explain that, like...
Well, no, he does get the opportunity to go, it's me, your Uncle Scrooge.
Well, no, he goes to Fred's house, but like we don't get like the ending scene of him like eating Christmas dinner with them. Like, instead...
And carving the roast beast.
From there, we pretty much go right into Bows. Like, right after we get the whole, like, and Scrooge became a second father to Tiny Tim. And all of that stuff. During Bows, pretty much all I wrote down was wholesome. For all of the operatic melodrama, I thought this was good. Pretty much my only searing critique is that we couldn't really, like, make out the words or see the staging very clearly. Like, it was hard to tell which actor was which. But I definitely like the heart of this adaptation. I like the concept. I like the medium. I like, for the most part, how they took advantage of this medium. I think that if this, say, were to be done in, like, a more professional theater with, like, a more professional recording and more professional, like, staging and costumes, because those were pretty much my only complaints. Now, that may be partly because I couldn't understand what they were saying, so then maybe I would have complaints about lyrics and whatnot. But, musically, I really don't have any critiques, and this is coming from someone who has a background in music and theater.
So once again, dear listener, we're asking you to help pay for our trip to wherever exactly this was produced and to go see it this Christmas.
If they're doing it again. This is like 2 years old. I hope they're doing it again, because like I said, I think this is worthy of...
becoming a tradition.
Exactly. I liked it.
All right. I think that's... So, final verdict, we liked it.
Yeah, we haven't really been doing, like, CinemaSins, like, final verdicts on these.
This is not a movie review podcast. It's a movie analysis podcast, and not always movies.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, that's also why you've noted we haven't, like, been grading them, or, like, I joked about the point system. There is no point system. I think I'd be bad as an objective reviewer, because I always have, like... Well, you know, I liked this. I don't know if it was good, but I liked it. Or this was good, but I still disliked it.
You're not Roger Ebert.
No, I'm Nora Schultz.
And I'm Ben Schultz.
Ooh, that was smooth.
And you have been listening to Trying to Adapt.
Thank you.